Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the meaning of going forth. The Buddha describes himself not as the Buddha, but as the Tathagata, the one who has gone forth. He then taught how all of those interested could themselves go forth and leave the sense pleasures of the world behind and awaken. This talk was presented at our Saturday morning Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 9th, 2016.
This morning's article and talk is on going forth and what that means. The Buddha never called himself the Buddha or a Buddha or even an awakened one. He always and consistently referred to himself as the Tathagata, T-A-T-H-A-G-A-T-A, sometimes T-H-A. And what that means is the one who has gone forth. And a little bit broader interpretation of Tathagata means he's the first one who has gone forth. And that's significant. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in the article. But what it means is that he's a human being, and he's the first one who realized the true nature of reality, and then he taught anyone else who was interested how to do the same. And the only difference between the Buddha, the Tathagata, and other awakened human beings is just that. The people that awakened, like all of us, after the Buddha and through the Buddha's teaching are called arahants. And that simply means an awakened human being. There's nothing terribly special about it, except that's really the point. So let me read a little bit of this. The Buddha called himself the Tathagata, which means one who has gone forth. Good morning, Stefan. How are you? Which means one who has gone forth and has, through his own efforts, awakened to the truth of reality. He described these truths in his very first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta setting the wheel of truth in motion. Everything the Buddha would teach for the 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of this very first teaching. I was in a discussion with an online student talking about all the different presentations of Buddhism, and one of his questions was, he's been practicing Buddhism for many, many years, and he says the biggest difficulty he has is trying to figure out what's most important. And how you can really understand what the Buddha actually taught is if it's consistent within the context of the Four Noble Truths. In other words, the Buddha presented these Four Noble Truths in his first teaching, and everything he taught for the next 45 years was in that context. And if it falls out of that context of the Four Noble Truths, it's something that the Buddha didn't teach. Doesn't mean that it might not be valuable, but to me, I'm more interested in what the Buddha taught. And then the question came up, well, how do you know it's authentic? No one knows for sure the exact words of the Buddha, but when you read the Pali Canon, what is most striking is the consistency in what is presented there and how, again, everything points back to that, the Four Noble Truths. So one who has gone forth is one who has left the sense pleasures and sense distractions of the world behind. Arahants are those that have developed the Buddha's Eightfold Path and have themselves become rightly self-awakened. And that's an important term that the Buddha used throughout his teaching career, rightly self-awakened. What it means is that we engage in this practice of awakening. It's not imposed on us. It's not given to us as a reward for doing something right or living a virtuous life. It's developed within each and every one of us. And what is so important about that is when you really understand that, rightly self-awakened, it's so empowering. Arahants are no longer attached to the pursuits of attainment, acquisition, and avoidance. Having left the world behind, an arahant is at peace. Arahants live their lives in lasting peace and happiness with dispassionate mindfulness of life as life occurs that has been developed through the Eightfold Path. When the Buddha left his father's palace, leaving behind his wife and infant son, he had gone forth in a very literal physical sense. He left behind power, possessions, responsibilities, and family in order to seek understanding without these distractions. This was a common, socially acceptable, and practical occurrence among spiritual seekers at the time. The tradition of wandering and seeking was supported by those that remained attached to the world and its responsibilities and distractions. In exchange for the support of householders, seekers would pass on their understanding to them. The knowledge gained and passed on was seen as a benefit to all of society. So I'm often asked, wasn't that a very very selfish thing that the Buddha did? Leaving his family, leaving his infant son, and walking around northern India for 6 years. At the time, that was a very acceptable thing to do to begin with. But also, the Buddha was driven by one thing, to understand the cause of human suffering, and then how to develop a way to end that. And of course, he was doing that not just for himself, but for everyone, including his family. The Buddha's mother, son, and father all took to the Dhamma and awakened. In fact, his son Rahula became a very important monk in throughout the Buddha's teaching career and throughout the Buddha's life in establishing the Dhamma. While it is certainly possible to go forth as the Buddha and the monks and nuns of his time had done and join monasteries or simply wander in search of understanding, it is much less socially accepted or practical today. In the West and most of the East today, the support for the monastic community is just not there. There is not much societal value placed on developing spiritual understanding in those who teach the Dhamma. This initial going forth, though, was not the only culturally accepted form of developing understanding. 2,600 years later, the Dhamma is still available in the same form that the Buddha presented it. Most of us will not or cannot leave the world behind physically and don robes. However, we can go forth in our practice in the same manner that was done in the past. It is going forth at the Dhamma, the authentic teachings of the Buddha, develops in every wholehearted practitioner. Taking true refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, is going forth, developing the experience of the cessation of the distraction of stress and unhappiness, or dukkha, through the Eightfold Path is going forth. Shamatha Vipassana meditation is going forth. That simple act that we do every time we engage in meditation, we're putting the world behind in a very literal sense. That the meditation method that the Buddha taught and that we use here, when we're caught up in our thoughts again, recognize it and come back to the sensation of breathing, that is interrupting our constant attachment to external sensory input. It's interrupting our connection to the external world in a very real way. The simple and pure act of meditation is an act of going forth, of leaving the world behind. When Shamatha Vipassana meditation is developed and practiced within the framework of the Eightfold Path, then meditation becomes an integrated experience of going forth as the Buddha, the Tathagata, experienced over 2,600 years ago. Engaging the Dhamma wholeheartedly is going forth. As practitioners of the Dhamma, we disengage from the distractions of the world through holding in mind all factors of the Eightfold Path as best we can. When our thoughts, words, or deeds are not in accordance with the Eightfold Path, the refined mindfulness supported by Shamatha Vipassana meditation brings us into awareness. We are able to remain mindfully in the world physically without being entangled in the distractions of the world. Are there any questions about what I've read so far? Or how this notion of going forth applies to us in the practice of the Dhamma? So, as we're developing the Eightfold Path, most people start recognizing right speech or wrong speech almost initially. You know, that's the first thing that people start talking about. I really see how my wrong speech is part of this. And that clearly shows where we're attached to the world when we're engaged in wrong speech or something that's there to establish and maintain an ego personality. Again, it's showing where our craving and clinging is arising. It's showing us where we are attached to the world, where we haven't gone forth and left the world behind. Does that make sense? Diane.
Something came to me earlier this morning after an earlier meditation, and it was, it came as sacred attachments. That I have sacred attachments, things that people, like father, mother, daughter, son, work, that these are sacred to me. Even God, even, you know, spiritual things all become like sacred attachments, and I was beginning to see how the attachment was so great to these sacreds that I could see attachments early on to, you know, craving and clinging things to ideas and stuff like that, but these sacred attachments were things that I didn't want touched, and I wanted to, you know, they were like, you know, holy or something like that, and it was just like a, you know, kind of an epiphany kind of thing of how it just, I could feel like a whole lot of things falling away and making it just feel like it would be easier to go with the flow, so to speak, without them. But I also was, I'm getting smart enough to be aware that this is just a recognition and awareness of these sacred attachments. They're not all going to, you know, go poof in one fell swoop.
They might.
Right.
But they usually won't. You bring up such an important point. The things that we hold most sacred, these concepts and ideas, are sacred because we have, those are the things that we have the most attachment to, or that we have the most of ourselves involved in, that we see ourselves in. And that's why it's so hard to let go of those things. So the mundane attachments that we have, the habitual attachments, the things that arise out of our conditioned mind that have no real lasting importance, we can tend to shed them pretty quickly. But without a sustained practice, we'll pick them right back up again. But it's these sacred things, these things that that nobody can touch, and we're not even willing to look at, that is really at the heart of the matter. And so when the Buddha talked about and used the word anatta, he's referring to these sacred ideas. And what he's saying is that these things that you're using to maintain a self is not a self. Let it go. And if you look at every one of these, no matter how sacred we might hold them, or that the world at large, or maybe a smaller community, a certain set of practitioners, they're the ones that are most distracting. Every one of these things, if you look at them closely, no matter how sacred it might be, keep using that word, is impermanent. And when the Buddha describes anatta in relation to impermanence, the three marks of existence, he's saying if it's impermanent, you have no control over it for one thing, so it can't be a self. And if it's impermanent, how could it be a self? And how could it be a self worth continuing to establish when it can't possibly be established? It just leads to more suffering, more confusion, more delusion, more suffering. And these sacred ideas, these sacred cows, are the ones that are most distracting. when it first sank in that the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths and nothing else, I understood it intellectually, but there were still parts of practice, because I had so much invested in it, that I wasn't willing to let go. But things that were a constant distraction and a constant delusion to eventually understanding what the Buddha was teaching. I just put so much effort into it that I wouldn't let it go. I mean, I took vows in a certain Buddhist school, and it took a while to realize that if I was going to continue developing understanding, I had to let go of those vows. And I actually did a ceremony formally denounced the vows. But the things that I was just talking to Ram about this too, the things that I had acquired along the way in my so-called Buddhist practice were the most difficult things to let go of. Eva?
You have been raised Catholic,
yep.
Christian, but you took on the study of Buddhism early on. Was that something, if I might ask, did you already have a release of your Catholicism before then, and then you changed? Or, you know, because, I mean, I was raised Catholic also, but I never really clung to it, I did when I was younger, but as I got older, I had already lost my religion, and then started, you know, exploring other things. Was that the same for you, or was it kind of like a more sudden...
It's a great question. I was... And I happen to know quite a few Catholics that practice what we do here, so it's not exclusive. But for me, since you asked the question, I really had a difficult time with the whole idea of religion from as early as I could remember, and especially the way it was presented to me. And I happen to be brought up, my parents were both very, very devout Catholics, my mom probably more than my dad, but it was a serious thing in the Haspel household. And so when I told them at 12 years old that I can't go to church anymore, it wasn't accepted very graciously. But I was, one of the things I was taught is that I should be afraid of this supreme creator. And that if I didn't do things a certain way, I was going to be punished. But also, if I did things in a very specific way, I would get rewarded. And that whole idea seemed kind of capricious to me, that there'd be, if there was such a thing as a supreme creator being, God, why would that God be so concerned with me in the first place? You know, and then all the other questions that arose. It just was too inconsistent for me to accept. By the time I was in my mid to late 20s, I was already involved in looking at Eastern religions. But it was, and I had put Roman Catholicism behind. But it took a long, long time for me to let go of the idea of a supreme creator God. And again, I'm not saying you shouldn't have that belief. For me, it was important to get to that point where I could let that idea go, because underlying that was always something that was pulling the strings or pointing me in a certain direction that wasn't of my own choosing. When the Buddha taught, for the 45 years he taught, he never ever said there's no such thing as a God or a creator God. Never said it. When the question was put to him in many different ways, his response always was and consistently was, that question does not lead to the goal, or even the answer to that question does not lead to the goal, which the Buddha's goal was complete release from craving and clinging. Especially clinging to views. So again, he never said there is, he never said there isn't. He said that it's not that important. And so, boy, I'm giving you a real long answer. To my way of thinking right now, I don't know if there's such a thing as a creator God or not. And I honestly don't care. Because what's most important, when I first developed an understanding of what the Buddha taught, it was like that aha moment. I said, now there's something here that if I take responsibility for my life and my own well-being, I can awaken. And it has nothing to do with anything external. And that's what the Buddha taught. He always used that word, and you hear me use it a lot, ehipasiko, come and see for yourself. That sounds nice. But it's so profound. What he's saying is, take to the Dhamma and you can have the same realization that I did. Go forth, however you can. I'll finish the article in a second. But what he means, leave the world behind. Leave that kind of constant need to chase sensory fulfillment and meaning through your senses. And develop an understanding of those three marks of existence. That's the only thing that we really need to concern ourselves with. To understand that interplay between impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. And a higher creator being has nothing to do with that, does it? You can believe it or not. But as far, and again, you can be a very devout practicing Christian, whether it's Catholic or anything, and still develop the Dhamma. I think at some point you might come up against that. But so my response, and my answer is, I don't know. One of the things that has happened when I let go of that is I've become a much better person. I've become, interesting enough, I'm much more compassionate. I'm much more present for people. I don't get caught up in... I remember when I was 7 or 8 years old, I was sitting in parochial school, right? I was a little bit of a nasty kid, so the nun put me right in front of her. She had this tall, she was a tiny little woman, she had this big lectern, and she looked like, anyway, she put me there because I was always wise and off. She could put me away. So I asked her one day, and I thought it was a reasonable question. I said, what's the difference between a Methodist and a Catholic? And that was such a threat to her that she hit me. I mean, she did that a lot. She used a lot. But even that, I was 7 or 8 years old, and it got me thinking, how could that be? How could there be such a problem with even asking that simple question? What's the difference between two Christian schools? But it is such a threat, isn't it? And look at what's taken place just in my life. I forget about the religious wars that have been fought over the thousands of years. Just in our lifetime, most of the conflicts on our planet are based on religion. And I'm not putting any religion down. I think part of the problem is the underlying push to assimilate everything and come up with this grand one-world religion, I think that's creating more of an extremism than anything else. People feel like they're losing their identity. Rather than acknowledge and honor people for what their beliefs are, we're trying to make one big thing out of this new age. And it doesn't work. People should be able to believe what they want to believe, practice what they want to practice, and that's exactly what the Buddha taught. He taught something that anybody can incorporate into their lives, no matter what their beliefs are, take to it wholeheartedly, and awaken. And awaken in this lifetime. Again, he didn't teach anything about do it all right, and when you die, you're going to get a reward. Right now. He taught how to develop lives of lasting peace and happiness in a very practical and direct way in this lifetime. And that's so freeing when you realize that that's the point. Let me go just read a little bit further, and then we'll talk about it. Where was I? The Pabaha Sutta describes going forth. The Dhamma practice develops the experience of leaving the world behind while continuing to live in this mental, physical world. We lose attachment to the world and go forth into the open air of dispassionate mindfulness. So a lot of people use this word spaciousness to describe how they're developing mindfulness through the Dhamma. I think some of you have talked about that here. That spaciousness is there. It feels like there's more room between our thoughts because our thoughts aren't so attached to everything. Last week we talked about the relaxation of thoughts. There's not this intense drive to establish an ego personality in every thought anymore. That's another way of saying we're developing the concentration needed to awaken. Okay, concentration or a non-distracted state. These are the Buddha's words. I saw that the household life is crowded and dusty, while going forth brings the open air. Remember, the Buddha was a prince in his father's kingdom, and he's describing that life as dusty and crowded. Seeing this, I went forth. On going forth, I then abandoned unskillful thoughts, words, and deeds. He abandoned thoughts, unskillful thoughts, words, and deeds. He abandoned the way that he was relating to the external world through his senses in an unskillful way. I went to Rajagaha, to the fortress of the Magadhans. I wandered for alms. Encountering Kim Bimbisara, he saw the signs of awakening in me. Look at this handsome, pure, and stately one before us. His demeanor is calm, his eyes downcast. Send four royal messengers to follow him. He wanted the messengers to see if the Buddha was legit. The Buddha. I went from house to house, well restrained. My sense gates guarded. Well restrained. The ego personality doesn't want any restraints put on it, does it? And one of the biggest difficulties that people that begin Dhamma practice, and it happens in class often, what happens to me when I start restraining myself? Like that's a bad thing. And we're almost taught that we should be, what's that? There's a phrase that comes to mind. Life is a banquet, and if you leave hungry, you did something wrong. Well, that's just the opposite of restraint, isn't it? The Buddha's teaching, one of the ways that he teaches us is to not be enamored with the world, not be so in love with the world that we can't let go of any of it, that we constantly need this sensory fulfillment. He's teaching restraint, and he's teaching restraint as a good thing, not as a way of denying ourselves anything. Remember, the Buddha taught a middle way, and when he described the middle way, he said it's between the extremes of extreme asceticism, complete denial of our bodily needs, and extreme sensory indulgence. It's a middle way. It allows us to be human beings while we awaken as human beings through reasonable restraint.
Gentle.
Gentle restraint. Yes. Including that act of non-restraint of beating ourselves up because we're not doing things correctly or good enough or not meditating long enough and all of that. That's an act, that's a lack of restraint when we're doing that to ourselves, when we're judging ourselves harshly. Gentle restraint, thank you, Diane. Gentle restraint is understanding that we're human beings and we're doing the most important thing we can do. awaken. Another word that I use for awaken often, because I think it better describes it, is to be a fully mature human being. So awakening doesn't mean, some of the schools it's taught that when you awaken as a human being, poof, you vanish and you're somewhere else. That scared me for a long time too. I really didn't want that, but I thought that was where I was going. The Buddha awakened. He didn't vanish. He lived the most effective, compassionate, successful human life ever for 45 more years after he awakened. Why? Because he was fully mature. What does mature mean? It means we understand what's going on. You think about the difference between a little infant and as they grow. They understand a little bit more the older they get. Until we get to about 14 or 15 and our egos are fully formed, then we don't understand anymore. I went from house to house, well restrained, my sense gates guarded. I remained mindful and alert, my alms bowl filled. So that's very descriptive. He's not talking about a full bowl of food. His alms bowl is full. He has everything he needs now. I left for Mount Pandava. There I stayed. Three messengers joined me from King Bimbisara. One returned. He told the king, "King, the monk sits unwavering, mindful, alert, calm, like a lion in his lair." Hearing these words, the king set out from Mount Pandava. Upon arrival, he sat to the Buddha's right and said, "You are young and strong. You have the look of nobility and of a warrior. You could lead an army. I offer you wealth. Tell me your birth." "King, I was born in the foothills of the Himalayas in a land of energy and wealth, the land of the Kosalans. I am Sakyan by birth." Now King Bimbisara knows where he's from. I can't think of his name. Yeah. "I have left that royal life and gone forth, not in search of sensual pleasures, but in renunciation as respite from the world." As respite from the world. He's given himself a break. "I strive for understanding, and that strive for understanding is what brings me delight." Now think about what the Buddha is talking to one of the most powerful people in the world at the time. It'd be like sitting down with a president or anybody, any leader of the world, and he's saying, "Leave all that behind. I've found true happiness, and it's not through that way." The Buddha, having left the sense pleasures of the world behind, freed himself from confusion, delusion, and further suffering. He personally taught thousands of others to do the same. Many would leave the householder's life and join him as monks and nuns. Many others remained involved with the world, having jobs, businesses, and families. Both groups would find that the Buddha's Dhamma will develop release from sensory distractions and clinging to confused and deluded views and awaken. So that last little part points to there were probably just as many people that remained as householders during the Buddha's lifetime as joined him and became a monk and a nun, or nuns in his sangha, and awakened. And some of the ones were that awakened as householders, or the ones that had stayed in the world but had learned to leave the world behind through the Dhamma, became so important. Anatha Pandika comes to mind, who was a very wealthy businessman during the time of the Buddha. And it was because of his support of the Buddha. One of the first things he did is he gave the Buddha a big block of land in the forest so that they had a safe place to be. But throughout the Buddha's life, Anatha Pandika supported the Buddha financially, but also in many other ways. The Buddha became, when any leader got wind of a new spiritual teacher, they did just what Bimbisara did. They wanted to investigate and find out if this guy was legit. Excuse me. And once they realized that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, most of the kings took him under their wing too. And that was important. I'll tell just one more story about how important it was to remain a householder and still develop awakening, just as it is today. About 300 years after the Buddha passed, there was a king called King Ashoka. Some of you have heard me tell the story. King Ashoka was one of the most brutally violent leaders that the world has ever seen. You can think about the modern ones that we all know about. He was much worse than that. King Ashoka came across the Buddha's teaching one day, took it to heart, practiced wholeheartedly, and awakened. And he never harmed another soul. In fact, it's because of King Ashoka that we have such a good knowledge of the Dhamma today. All over northern India, and even southern India, there's still these rock edicts E-D-I-C-T-S, I hope I'm saying it right, that have the words of the Buddha inscribed on it. From 2,200 years ago, you can still see these things. They still carry that message that King Ashoka used to awaken. He was the first ruler, as far as we know, that began free health care for everyone. He had universal health care back 2,200 years ago. He was so taken by the Dhamma and so awakened, he went from this incredibly bloodthirsty human being. He had, all over northern India at the time, there were pikes with heads on them because he wanted to show people how powerful he was by showing how many people he killed. From that to starting universal health care, then he went even further. He started universal veterinary care for animals 2,200 years ago by taking to the Dhamma. A practical, and the reason why I love that story is it's such a practical understanding of what the Dhamma is about. It's not about going anywhere. It's about going forth, but not leaving the world, having a very, very effective and powerful impact in a compassionate way on the world around us. So I always say here that the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all other beings is to awaken. If we're really concerned about the world, like most people are, the most important thing we can do is take to the Dhamma and awaken. And then we can have that skillful effect that others have had before us. In the meantime, getting back to today's talk, what we're going to do in just a minute, Samatha Vipassana meditation, is a direct way of going forth in our meditation practice. And then as we develop the Eightfold Path and we refine our mindfulness to hold in mind all eight factors of the Eightfold Path, we're living our lives, we're involved in the world in a much more meaningful way than we ever had been before, but we're no longer attached to it. What occurs is simply what occurs. That refined mindfulness is developed through the Dhamma, that mind of equanimity, is able to stay present with whatever's occurring and no longer chases sensory indulgences and no longer rejects things that might have caused one to run away from the world. We're simply present with what occurs. And that's the essence of an awakened human being. We're present with life as it occurs. We see life as it occurs. We don't need it to be any different than it is. We learn the profound difference between acceptance and approval. Simply, this is what's going on. I have to accept it, but I don't need to approve it. So that's today's talk. We're going to go around. We're going to meditate and go around the room. But any questions about this? Okay. So for Ellen, Shamatha Vipassana meditation. Shamatha means to quiet the mind. Vipassana means to gain insight, and it's a very specific type of insight. It's insight into the three marks of existence: impermanence, anatta, and dukkha. If you've never heard that before, don't worry about it. The point of all of that is that meditation alone will not develop what we've been talking about here. The Buddha taught meditation as one factor of the Eightfold Path. So meditation is primarily for developing deep concentration so that it can support the refined mindfulness that's necessary to develop the Eightfold Path. And that's really what we talk about here. We meditate, we talk about the Eightfold Path, and incorporating these teachings into our lives. And don't let that even overwhelm you. It starts with meditation. There's a booklet out there, a yellow booklet. Please take that. It describes Shamatha Vipassana meditation in this broader framework. And then please be part of our Sangha. And that's what we talk about here, is how to incorporate that Eightfold Path as a broader framework for our Dhamma practice. So welcome to our Sangha. Let's meditate. I'll talk us into it. It doesn't really need any more explanation. So gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. Excuse me. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like, to be mindful of your breath in your body. Holding your back straight, but not stiff. Your ears aligned with your shoulders and your nose aligned with your navel. Holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies. and settle into your minds. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings. Thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. not following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two, recognize it as impermanent, and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 5 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, you can gently open your eyes. So I'd like to hear how your meditation practice is developing, and if you have any questions that have come up from today's talk, and I'll start with Jen. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I like the kind of realization that I'm having where the Eightfold Path, and some of what you were saying today relates to this. It's like the Eightfold Path helps me, and I feel like I need to use one of the factors, so like, say, right speech. Wrong speech helps me highlight the times when ego is like sort of taking over or we're in control. And I just, that's been really helpful because I feel like before it was, the emphasis was on right speech, which is good, but the emphasis was on this like, no, it has to be right speech, and that kind of became a little distracting because I would then start to beat myself up, and now it's like, oh, there's wrong speech. Ego's in control. Let's just take a minute. Like, 5 seconds, even if I'm, like, talking to somebody else. It just, kind of, just that highlighting makes things seem more gentle.
That's great. That's such important insight, Jen. When the moral and ethical factor, the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path are, there's a lot of reasons why they're there, but primarily it's to understand where we're clinging, to an ego personality. Remember, the Buddha described awakening in one of two words, released or abandoned. We've abandoned clinging. We emptied ourselves of clinging. And so they're there to show us where we're clinging. And in a very dispassionate way, when the Buddha taught mindfulness, he didn't teach a general type of mindfulness, although that's usually good. He taught to be mindful of the factors of the Eightfold Path. When in the words that he used, or the way they're translated, is when engaged in wrong speech, be mindful of that and enter and remain into right speech, to know where we're hanging, where we're clinging, where we're attached. So it's such great insight. Simple too, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you. Stefan, good to see you this morning.
When you were reading the article, I liked that phrase. I think you read something like the Buddha conducted himself restrained with the sense gates guarded.
Yeah.
But that made sense in terms of how my mind feels sometimes, you know, the difference between sort of being alert for what sensations come up and sort of catching them at face value there versus, you know, if your sense gates are unguarded, then something comes up and all of a sudden your mind is just chasing after it.
Yeah.
And later you realize your thinking has gone several steps ahead of where you are now, and you feel this kind of tension or imbalance because your mind isn't where you really are.
It's mindlessness then, you know?
Yeah.
We're driven by our senses. When our sense gates aren't well restrained, we're mindless in a very real way. Thank you for bringing that up. For those that don't know, some new people here, Stefan operates the Tinicum CSA, the Community Supported Agricultural Farm, just across the Frenchtown Bridge. And I got the produce that I keep coming back to last year's turnips. I can't get them out of my mind. They were so good. They were just turnips, but they were something special. And there's a flyer up there, too.
Yeah, we have flyers in the lobby. And a lot of people who are members of our CSA like it a great deal, so maybe you would, too.
Yeah, it really is outstanding stuff. Glad you're here this morning. Ellen, welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you.
How was your meditation?
I was fighting with a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, and that's the method. See, if you remember that Shamatha Vipassana meditation within this framework is primarily for developing concentration, that's all you're doing. Recognize you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to the sensation of breathing, and then develop it within that wider framework. So if you're just starting out or reinvigorating a practice, start with short periods of meditation, 3, 4, 5 minutes. And if you can do that twice a day. But consistency is much more important in establishing a meditation practice than length of time. The longer sessions will come naturally if you allow it. But if you try for too long a meditation session, you'll likely just get frustrated and not do it. And be part of our Sangha. We'd like to have you here. Take that yellow booklet, and you can go on the website, crossovermeditation.com, and sign up for the newsletter. I send that out. Good. So you get it. I'm glad you're here. How did you find us?
I was Googling meditation classes in this area.
Oh, good. It's nice to know that we get noticed on the search engine. So.
Yeah.
Good. Eva, good morning. It's good to see you.
I find practice very challenging in just about every aspect. And I find that challenge and the fact that I'm still with it very comforting. Mm. I like that the Buddha said, or rather the Buddha never said there was or there wasn't this ultimate goal, because I tend to think, okay, once I get there, then I'm done, I'm finished, I don't have to. And the fact that I don't really know where I'm going kind of says, all right, well, don't worry about it, just kind of stay here and see how this moment is going. And
Ehepisiko.
I find that works, because as often is happening as I'm going along, I'll find, wow, I didn't say something just then, whereas normally it would have been, oh, I'm going to put you in your place if you say something. And so I'm noticing these things, but one of the major things that I've noticed is that even the way I'm treating my cats, I have 3 cats, and even the way I'm relating to them is different. And in a very rewarding way, and who would have thought?
Yeah, that's another, the most, I always say, the most loving thing we can do for ourselves and our pets is to awaken. I know my dog really appreciates me that I meditate. you said something very profound, Eva, that you don't know where you're going. The Buddha never described where we're going except to say that we're unbound or released from clinging. You can't describe what that's like, because it has to be experienced. But there's an Eightfold Path that leads us there. Just like any path, you're walking along the towpath, you don't know what's going to happen when you get to Milford, but if you're aware of right where you are right here, it's a pretty nice walk. You know, that's where that framework comes in. So, thank you. Mark, good to see you again.
It's been a little while.
Yeah. We missed you.
Yeah, I missed you. So I'm very happy to be back. My practice has been consistent.
Good.
So twice a day. I noticed over time, as life has gotten busier, that I've gone to shorter meditation periods to keep the consistency. And I do actually just want to take a moment to thank everyone for being here, because kind of being away for a little while with life getting in the way really made me appreciate so much more how important it is to be here. Special is.
Yeah.
So thank you all for that. And, I guess I've just been running up against what it really means to wholeheartedly engage in battle practice. I feel like logically. Because it means sacrificing things that we hold tightly to. And I start to see that more and more in the talks this morning. Have been very helpful to realize that. So I want to engage in it wholeheartedly, and I want to let those things go. The next step is to
It's good to have you back. That's one of those mostly undefinable terms anyway. It's different for everyone. The sixth factor, the Eightfold Path, right effort kind of explains it. Right effort just means that you need to put some effort into this. You need to put some time aside to meditate and to develop first intellectually what the Eightfold Path means, just to become acquainted with it. And then, as best we can, to just incorporate it into our lives. When you recognize that you're engaged in wrong speech, if you didn't have the concept first, the intellectual concept of such a thing as right speech, you wouldn't notice when you're doing something that's wrong speech, whatever that might be, and all the other factors. If you didn't understand that right view is initially the view that I don't understand the Four Noble Truths, so I'll develop that, the Four Noble Truths would be meaningless and they would be unreachable because you're not inclined that way. So that's all it is. So I'm glad you're here and thank you for saying that. Diane, good to see you this morning.
Three girls and a boy. And the other day, I mean, this has been the first week. And, of course, the first day, everything was roses and ice cream and, beautiful. And they liked me and I liked them and everything. And the second day, the testing began. And it's amazing how cruel children can be. We don't, develop cruelty, really, in adulthood. We carry it with us from childhood. And anyway, they started being cruel Tuesday and Wednesday, and just a natural. I felt a bit of tension, and I know my usual MO would be get in there and control and correct behavior and stuff. But it wasn't. I mean, it was just I was aware of it, and then what I did was I got a chair and I put it in front of a window where I could look out at the forest, and I just sat there and looked out at the forest while they were doing, they were ostracizing themselves from me. They were escaping into their room kind of thing. And I just sat there and I felt good. I was at peace. And they came out, and all three came out. The oldest came out with a book, and they all sat there and read the book. And then they all went back into the room. I think they came out to see what I was doing and stuff. I mean, the testing was continued for the 2 days. There were 2 days of that, and I just maintained my. I mean, the thing that was really kind of amazing was, if I say the words, I maintained my peace and serenity. I didn't consciously do it. I just was it. I don't know whether that kind of, it didn't bother me. I saw that they were doing that, so I just sat and looked at the forest. And it was, by the end of the week, like, the kids changed in their whole attitude and everything that was going on. I'd give you the whole week, but time, but anyway, it's just amazing how in every part of, and then my second job, it's making a difference too. It's really, really, I'm very grateful for your steadfastness and being here consistently and continually. It really, it means a lot, and I really appreciate learning what the Four Noble Truths are and the Eightfold Path. Changed my life.
Yeah. You're welcome. Changed mine too. And the results of developing the Dhamma are entirely practical. This is how it leads to situations. I would say that babysitting four kids is a good expression of the First Noble Truth. But you didn't experience it. You by not wanting the situation or the kids to be any different than they are, you maintain your equanimity. That's the point of the Dhamma. The Buddha described the First Noble Truth, saying that these are the worldly conditions. There's an unsatisfactory, underlying unsatisfactory nature to human life. But you don't have to react. And if you let go of craving and clinging, you no longer will have a reactive mind.
It's amazing how life then reacts to you when you don't react.
Yeah. Yeah. And
the kids
had nothing.
Supposed to react.
Yeah. There was nothing for them to push up against.
Yeah.
Nothing left for them to test.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing that up. Ellie, it's good to see you this morning.
Which are exempt, because it seems so extreme to me, so impossible that I could not accept it. But anyway, now I realize that okay, I accept it, even though I vehemently opposed it. It is the way it is.
Yeah.
And I'll have to move on from there next week and see what that means. But I feel like I have some wrong speech to apologize for. My staff, I wasn't really setting a good example. You know, and everyone agreed with me, you know.
Yeah. Well, of course
it
did.
Wrong. They did.
Yeah.
It was really interesting.
That's great. Ellie, thank you so much. You described the difference between acceptance and approval. You don't approve of what's going on. That doesn't mean that you can't accept it. And you accept it because it's what's occurring. That's all. The next thing isn't, well, what's occurring is lousy. Well, that's approval. You see things clearly.
Well, the other thing I realized was how much ego was invested in it.
Yeah.
And I never really, you know, I thought about that a lot, you know, as far as right livelihood and, you know, how much ego was involved with my job. And I really didn't think there was much, but the level of my emotions made me realize, of course, there is.
Yeah.
So that was really eye-opening.
If you use the word anatta instead of ego,
yeah,
and you see what happened there, your two-year project is going along great, impermanence and uncertainty intervene, and everything's different. And that ego personality, anatta, reacts, and there's suffering. Those are the three marks of existence. And a very beautiful and practical look at that, how those three marks were right there in that situation. And besides the reaction, you handled it beautifully because you gained deeper insight. It's not, you know, it's not wrong that we react. I think Diana, maybe you were...
Mm-hmm.
That's a harsh judgment. That's an extreme view that I should be different than this. I shouldn't have had wrong speech. When you learn from it, that's the whole point. It's the whole point of the framework of the Eightfold Path, so we can see these things develop. So, thank you. Mary, it's good to see you.
My practice has been going well. I'm up to about 15 minutes twice a day.
Oh.
I find myself more and more just in daily life catching myself in wrong thought and delusional thoughts, and like, you know, why are we involved there? I mean, let's just deal with what's going on right now. Because when I get caught up in those thoughts, it just leads to anxiety.
Yeah.
And, you know, say something or even have to respond to something that somebody posted, I'm just like, no, there's no reason. I mean, this is what is said, and I have to check myself and not feel that I need to put my two cents in, but frequently my two cents is not going to add anything positive. There's no point.
Yeah. That's good. That's an aspect of right speech. If it's not going to have any meaningful effect, we'll keep our mouth shut.
Yeah.
It's such a nice way to live, too, isn't it?
We just
don't get entangled in all these little things that come up.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that.
So much to stuff. I don't react as much.
Yeah.
To things. It's simply
is
an opinion or whatever.
Yeah. I don't have to force my ego personality on a situation. Life's a lot more pleasant. Thank you, Mira. Glad you're here. Debbie, it's good to see you.
Good to see you. Nice to be here. Nice to reiterate what Eva said. It's so comforting. In terms of my practice, I feel like I'm getting a little more consistent. Not necessarily 2 times a day, though I've started that on some days.
Great. I'm glad you're here, and again, this is what this is about. This is what a sangha is for, you know, to support each other. You know, just because we're involved with the Dhamma doesn't mean life is going to be wonderful all the time. In fact, it isn't. The First Noble Truth says it's not going to be that way. But we can learn skills that you're learning, you know, to not react to it, to let things be. When life stinks, we're allowed to feel that life stinks. The Dhamma tells us that it can't be any different than it is right now. And why is that? Because it's what's occurring. Now, it's the only reason. There's no magical or mystical answer to life's troubles. There it is. It's just part of life. So I'm glad you're here.
It's just the whole impermanence in your face. That,
yeah. But that also leads to an understanding that no matter what's going on, it will change.
Yeah.
You know? Absolutely. Yeah. And what that... Ultimately, what that means is what's going on in my mind can change instantly based on my point of view. The more I've developed right view, the more I can see things clearly, the less reactive I get. And it's all a process. You've made remarkable progress. You've just been coming here 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks. Yeah, it's remarkable. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're all here. Just a couple of quick announcements. 2 weeks from today is a mindfulness-based recovery workshop right here. There's a flyer out there. And a website with more information, mindfulnessbasedrecovery.com. We're 6 weeks from our retreat. Our spring retreat is May 19th to the 22nd up at the Juan Dharma Center in Claverack, New York. That's really going to be a wonderful time. The Tuesday after our retreat, May 24th, is our next Dhana dinner at Love and Oven. And I think there's some flyers out there on that, too. That's all the announcements. There was one other one, but...
What time is it?
The Dhana dinner?
No. What time is it now?
10:06.
Okay. I'm sorry.
That's all right. We'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. The words of the Buddha. I'll see you next week, Diane.
Yeah.
So metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and sometimes I use my own interpretation of this, if that's the right way to put it. But I also like to read the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta, And I'll just preface it just a little bit. The Karaniya Metta Sutta shows that the most loving and compassionate action that anyone can take is to engage wholeheartedly, there's that word again, wholeheartedly with the direct teachings of the Buddha and awaken. These are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. The great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downward to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful Dhamma class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.